You're listening to the good.
Don't call me Paino.
The bad.
Absolute.
And the rugby.
Folded like a deck chair.
With Paino, Lord, and the Husk. I don't know what that means.
Hello, everybody, and a very warm welcome to the good, the bad, and the rugby. It's nice to be back with you. My name is Alex Payne. It's been another busy week in the world of ruggers, as we know, including some cracking games in the Premiership at the weekend. We'll get into that a little bit later on. But before that, it is time to welcome another permanent member of the GB&R team. Hask and Tins, as we know, have been part of the furniture since time began. The Lord is here this week as well. How are you, the Lord?
I'm very good, thank you. Always good to be here. What a weekend. Our predictions were bang on, as always. So let's load up and go again.
Feeling quite good on some of those. Before we get into the rugby, though, we've obviously added Ellis Genge recently as well. It's very good to have a current player on board and certainly a man who is not afraid of sharing a fairly forthright opinion. I think we did a bit of that last week, and apologies where the fire burns. But this week, we've never really had a lot of class and a lot of refinement around GB&R. We are fixing the leak in the roof in that regard. It's a very warm welcome to a man who played 243 times for Stade Francais, Leicester, Castres and Clermont, as well as being capped 37 times for France, currently obviously winning plaudits left, right and centre for his punditry on the BBC and ITV. It is bienvenue dans notre nouveau membre de l'équipe, le fantastique Benjamin Kaiser. How are you?
Thank you very much. I'm well, mate.
I was waiting for the background applause.
We need some sound effects, really, on this show, I think.
Yeah, we do.
It's very, very nice to have you as a fully paid up, fully signed up member of GB&R. As I said, we've been needing a little bit of refinement and a little bit of class at the top end of this show. And I'm hoping you're going to fill the chasm in that regard. Welcome aboard. Easy decision, or have we had to do quite a lot of tempting?
Nah, mate. I enjoy the tone, right? I enjoy the freshness. I enjoy the straightforwardness. And to be honest, if you want class after Hask, then I don't need to hit very, very hard. I don't know Genji really well, but to be honest, every time I listen to him, I feel that he's got zero filter, right? He's the same whether you see him before, after, during. And I appreciate that. So let's as long as we stick to that, and I'm super happy to be here, let's just drill into the reality of rugby and other things.
Good stuff. I'm conscious we've now got two members of the Front Row Union and two Leicester Tigers on our roster, or one former Leicester Tiger. Not quite sure what that says about the world of rugby right now. I don't know whether, because there was somebody put out something the other day actually about the fact that 90% of coaches in rugby at the moment seem to come from the forwards. Is that just a thing?
Maybe it means that we're greedy, greedy little pigs. What do you want me to say? Never want to let go.
I thought you might go with that's where the brains trust are kept. I don't know. But bizarre. How are you, Ben? What's been happening in your world? What's been keeping you busy?
I divide my time between a little bit of media work, some studying mainly, and then basically keeping my sanity at home. But I mean, the real news is that with all due respect to Sir Prime Minister, I mean, stuff the announcement at 7 p.m. tonight of Boris Johnson. The most important one is the announcement every night that I'm going to be listening out for is the new COVID cases in the French team, yes or no? That's the real sort of news thread that's going to be this week, and that's going to be my week.
How much is the French nation holding its breath at the moment around everything that's happening in that? Where is the camp? It's not Marcoussis, is it? Where is the camp?
Yeah. So basically, they did the first original camp in Nice to get a bit of sun, thinking they're going to go back to Marcoussis for 6-7 weeks consecutively, and then it makes it a little bit dull and a little bit sad. What people need to understand, so we're already very passionate people in France, okay? But this is much more. We've been waiting and, you know, shoveling shit for 10 years, and finally we're doing well, and there's always things coming in the way. There's the World Cup 2023 around the corner. There's the fact that we've been waiting for 10 years to finally be proud of the French jersey again and the way that we perform. It's not only just the performance, it's the way that they perform and their consistency and all that. And so the first big kill really was to miss out on Antoine Dupont. I think at the moment, people can't get enough of him. So if you think you guys are excited about him overseas, in France, he's just next level, because he's taken up, on top of being one of the top players, he's taken up the star power of this French team. You know, it used to be Frédéric Michalak, it used to be Chabal with his different ways, because obviously he was a bit of a freak. and he's taken all that. So we can't get enough at the moment where sport is playing its role as being, you know, putting a bit of smile on people's faces, putting you back into your spot of saying, yes, things are tough at the moment, okay, but you can watch a bit of rugby on TV and just enjoy it, and things will get better very soon.
Just on Dupont, how does he handle it all?
So how can I place this without being...
Because it's been noticed he doesn't smile, there's no emotion, he's sort of quite sort of surgical in the way that he plays and the way that he conducts himself. I just wondered if there was... Is there a bit more razzle-dazzle and red carpet action away from the rugby pitch, or is he very self-contained?
I think if you watch him closely, he's got a bit of fire in him, even on the pitch. He will go head-to-head against the biggest, the strongest, the meanest on the rugby field every single time, and he makes a point out of it. So he seems very nice and kind and this and that. Don't get me wrong. He's a beast. He's a beast with a very, very strong mindset. And that's what gets him through, basically, that extra edge. Apparently, off the field, He has the right balance of being absolutely the kindest dude you've ever met, to the most calm, composed, relaxed, down to earth. Yeah. But you always see he's got something in his eye that says that he reeks of self-confidence and of determination. But to be honest, I mean, if I was as good as him, if I was bumping people like that, I would be very confident also, you know? And so he's got a bit of lip, a bit of mouth when needed. So he's got that character basically that makes him not just a very powerful player, but actually, he is a lot more interesting. And to be honest, if you asked me the same question 18 months ago, I actually doubted him. So Morgan Power is my mate, right? So I had a bit of a loyalty issue in this thing. But I was sort of praising the number nines that would control a game, fantastic kicking game. They were there to be strategic sort of number nines that we love them in France. And Antoine Dupont, if you watch his, you know, the Wales game before the last Six Nations in October against Ireland, he makes Charles Olivon score another try, but it's the worst box kick you've ever seen, except for some whatever reason, because at the moment he's on, I don't know, he said in English, Sky Nine or whatever. He jumps over everyone, he picks it up, Cloud Nine, sorry. Yeah. And then he pivots on somebody else, hands off the last defender and gives it to Olivon. But it's just because, you know, I mean, Tins, you know that very, very well. When things are going your way, all of a sudden the bounces come your way, all of a sudden, you know, things just look good for you, right? That's how he is at the moment. So, but don't be fooled. Don't be fooled. He's got a bit of a devil inside him, but in a good way.
You have got it right. I do know where you catch a high ball, spin, hand off, offload. Yeah, that was me all day long.
You've watched a fair amount of that, haven't you?
I still think that, you know, he's this guy who just pulls all the strings, is unbelievably talented, but then he's the last person up. He's 6 a.m. in a nightclub just sipping on a whiskey, and he's like that cool dude too. That's how I'm picturing him. Loves it on the field, loves it off the field. That's mindset.
You were good at the whiskey in the 6 a.m., not quite so good at the pirouette in the sky.
All right, easy, Alex. Get down from your soapbox, will you?
My little stool.
15 years in a commentary box, never been on a pitch.
Very true, very true. I've watched enough, though. So we were going to start with Premiership this week. Should we crack into Six Nations? Because we've sort of got there. Would you want to go... Tell you what, let's make executive decision. Let's do Prem, because it was a belting weekend in the Premiership, and then we'll come on to Six Nations, and then we'll just leave it in the hands of the editors. They can work their magic depending on what comes out of the news lines. Let's start with the predictions, first of all, because we've had a pretty torrid time in it of late. But actually, there were some quite good nibbles this week, Tins. Where did you net out overall?
Yeah, it was a frustrating one, really, because in all fairness, we said when we did the Bet UK show, this is the hardest weekend to predict, because we felt there could be swings and roundabouts in every game, and you could make cases for everyone. Bath Gloucester, you picked a draw, and it possibly so should have been a draw, could have been, would have been. Red cards galore. Five red cards, four of the dullest red cards I've ever seen in terms of what you can and can't do now with current law and what, as a player, you should be doing right and wrong. I think the tackle in the air is old news, dumb by him, but ultimately it's been around for a while, whereas the red hot ones at ruck time and obviously the tackle time, shoulder to head, a bit more new, and they were some crackers in terms of just thickness, really.
Yeah.
I think Kieran Brooks was harshly done by. Anyone could have done that, but otherwise it was... Yeah, it was pretty blatant.
It's absolutely not a prerequisite to watch any rugby coming on this show, but I just wondered, do you watch the Premiership? Do you keep an eye on it, on Leicester?
I wanted to nod away on that whole chapter. That would have made my life easier. I do watch Leicester, but I've been disappointed so much, and just I actually don't understand where they're going. I don't understand what the problem is. I don't understand how they're gonna get out of it. When I finally see some good signings, and I see Lavanini going off again, and then I bumped into Jordi Murphy the other day around the Ireland France ITV work, and he actually looked probably happier than when I saw him 2 years ago. Because he was really? Just relieved from such a weight on his shoulder. I mean, I don't know if you guys know him, but he's a top dude with a massive heart who gave absolutely everything for this wonderful club as a player, as a leader, as a captain, as an assistant coach, as a head coach. I mean, imagine the pressure. I mean, he's given everything and he leaves empty. He leaves completely empty with zero left in his heart, with a sense of huge disappointment because he doesn't see... He thinks it's going to be a lot longer process than basically the directors have got in the back of their minds. And he doesn't see it happening overnight, you know. So a little bit disappointed by Leicester, but I do watch them. I do have a look at what they do. I'm not going to lie, that's pretty much the only thing that I look at.
Good on him. Tins, go on, you go again.
I was going to say, at the moment, they've turned a little bit of a corner. I would agree with you at the start of the year. No idea what the team is. You couldn't name the team on paper, which for a Leicester team is very rare. But at the moment, they seem to have turned a little bit of a corner and they're getting it done. And they're getting it done up front, aren't they? They're scoring tries from driving lineouts again. It's got Borthos written all over it. But, you know, there's been talk for years that perhaps the problems sit above and way above in the lofty heights of the boardroom rather than down on the ground floor. But we'll wait and see what happens.
Yeah. Quick one on London Irish as well. I mean, do you pay due credit to the Exiles or do you kind of wonder how Bristol managed to let that slip? 31-13 at one stage.
For me, as I said to you whilst we were having text banter, and I was sat as I usually do on my bike watching the game, and I'd taken my Bristol -6.5, and you know, even though I was on the bike pedalling up a hill on Zwift, I'd lit a cigarette and I was easy money, and then Irish had some great players on the bench, and then suddenly you see Pat Lam taking all his. You know, Piatow was amazing, and then suddenly he takes him off, and then you take the other, and then they're bringing on Nick Phipps, and they're bringing on Sean O'Brien, and you're like, hang on, there's some good players coming off the bench, and suddenly the tide just started to swing, and without even trying to do it, my cigarette extinguished, and sort of burned my fingers, and then next thing I knew, my bet was gone. So I credit Irish, obviously, because that's what substitutes are there to do. They're there to come on and make an impact. But I think Pat Lam would look back and I fully understand why he did it. When you're 20 points up, you're thinking that the game's in the bag, but it wasn't.
Ben, what was the best comeback in your career? Can you think of one? French rugby is synonymous with comebacks. I just wondered whether Clermont come back to you.
Question, actually. No. If you know the history of Clermont, you know that we were always ahead and it was more the other way around.
Yes, true.
But probably the only one that I've got the back of my head, it's not even a massive comeback, but it's my last game. It's the final of Top 14 2007 against my future Clermont, still with Stade Français. We should have been 30 points down at halftime. We were only down 12-0 or something. A massive bollocking from Mathieu Blain, the former hooker, who was... He actually cracked a joke to everyone at halftime. Bollocked us, cracked a joke, shed a tear. You know, the typical French sort, and all that in about all of that in about 90 seconds, as you do in France, obviously. And I mean, I'm sure, Tins, you were laughing about having a cigarette on your bike, but he probably had a cigarette behind him, and that was actually true, you know? And we came back, and we ended up scoring two late tries in the 70th minute and winning it.
Wow. And there's something about a comeback that's very, very romantic. It's just across sport. Tins, you had England-Australia 0-2.
Yeah.
Have any others?
No, I'm just literally trying to rack my brains about great comeback. I'm thinking of other ones that I wasn't involved in. France-New Zealand in rugby at the 99 World Cup. But none that I can't. I bet there has got to be one out there somewhere, but I can't think of what I can't think
we'll
of.
We'll set the gnaws on it. There's a challenge. Yeah. Which of the three, four of you, Ellis, Hask, Ben and Tins, had the greatest comeback? That'd be quite a good question. That's one for the Norse.
I guarantee Ellis isn't winning that because I don't think he's ever had a comeback yet. I mean, they haven't had to come back from anywhere, have they, yet, that England team? So
no. Well, club, we can have a look. And quick, well, you touched on Bath Gloucester as well. So I went with two draws for the weekend and I also thought Irish might sneak it against Bristol. So both of those came quite close. But Bath Gloucester, did Bath deserve it? not convincing.
Difficult one. I don't think you could convincingly state a case. I think actually Gloucester probably had a better first half than Bath did, but just, you know, obviously that red card early really hammered them. But it was like every red card seems to galvanise the team for a little while, and they went six up, and then, you know, 75th minute, you score in the corner, and you think you're home and hosed, and then you're international. Chris Harris, he milked that. Great actor. There's definitely an Oscar coming. And just this little bump, and he's done the full dive backwards and referee
platoon.
Yeah, and, you know, fair play. The wind looked like it was howling, and Rhys Peason, fair play to him, smashed it over from 45. So kicking themselves again. But these are the games that Gloucester have been losing all year. Those close games, they can't buy a win, and they're falling back on the joy of not having to worry about relegation, I think. So
true. We go again this weekend. We'll have another Premiership preview show out for you on Thursday, as we do every week of the Premiership season. It's on YouTube, and that's going to obviously come to you with our friends at BetUK.com, who are the official Premiership Rugby Predictor app. They're offering over 14 grand worth of prizes throughout this season, and the player with the most accrued points wins a 5 grand cash prize. You know the T's and C's by now. The app's available exclusively on BetUK.com's own app to players aged 18 and over. You can get it on iOS or on Android. Tournament 3 is underway, and if you'd like to get involved, it's very simple. Download the BetUK.com app, register or log in if you haven't already done so. Select the Premiership Rugby Predictor game from the menu. Make your prediction of a home win, a draw, or an away win for all six of the weekend's Prem Rugby fixtures. Submit those predictions ahead of the weekend. Hope you pick the winners. Good luck. Don't forget T's and C's apply. 18s and over only, please. BeGambleAware.org. Please gamble responsibly. We're getting closer, so come and play with us on Thursday if you haven't already. Some good little nibbles to be had. Just before we move on, a quick word on Dan Carter, who won 2 World Cups, 112 All Black caps, World Rugby's record point scorer, you know, just pretty much got it all, really. Average?
Yeah, from my point of view, in terms of playing opposite him on occasions, but mainly on the losing side, actually, since he took over, you know, just pure class to play at the standard that he played at for that many years. To the ability, they talk about it where you can... It makes it look like you slow the game down. And he did that. I vividly remember in the 2015 World Cup, obviously I went to both the semi-finals and the final. And I specifically spent a long time watching him. And every decision he made was correct. And a lot of the time it was just catch and pass. And it wasn't flash. And I often talk about, well, Greenwood had this ability to notice when was the right time to him to influence the game. And Dan Carter did that to pretty much perfection every game. It'd be catch, pass, catch, pass, catch. And at one time, people think, oh, he's just catching pass. And then bang, he's gone halfway through, offload. And that was just the sheer brilliance of him. Then if you tag in the skills he had in his locker, you know, we won't even talk about the right-footed kick in the World Cup final.
Yeah.
Show off. You know, he just epitomised what great rugby players are, and really annoyingly, he's actually quite a nice bloke as well, which is a little bit disappointing. You want to pick a flaw, don't you? Unfortunately, yeah. He's not very good looking, so we can fall back on that.
Did you, Ben, I'm going to quarterfinal?
Quarterfinal was my last game for France, but I wasn't picked for the 60 points hiding. But
right, therein was the game changer right there.
Absolutely,
Did you watch that and just think, Jesus, this All Black side is something else, or did you think, my God, French, what is happening to French rugby?
Yeah, that was more my way of seeing it. It was more to say, I mean, listen, especially in 2015, they were head and shoulders above anybody else. They were absolutely extraordinary in all their centurions, or whatever you call them. They just played and delivered. I was actually chuffed for them. I love when legends deliver at the right time, the right moment, you know? And they were there. And one of the big heroes of mine was Kevin Mealamu. And so I was actually really chuffed for him. He's the loveliest dude you've ever met. And so I was really happy. But... No, honestly, Dan Carter, what I love is that you can have the class, you can have the CV, you can have whatever. But as a bloke, you know, there's something mythical about the All Blacks, right? So there's something even more mythical about the number 10 jersey. And when you take all that, he was probably the hottest prospect, a bit the same way as fairness to Johnny Wilkinson for going to Toulon and challenging, you know, and still delivering there. You come with a target on the back of your head. And Dan Carter did the same thing when he came to Perpignan. He only played 7 games, but still his charisma and his leadership basically got Perpignan to the title. And I know for a fact that he celebrated the title as if he put 50 points in the final. And then he basically goes back and wins two World Cups. And everybody's like, listen, this guy is absolutely grilled. There's no point of getting him. And he's barely limping when he arrives at racing. But he still influences everybody and wins everybody's hearts by, like, it's not even a competition. And gets this racing team to win with one man down against Toulon and Barcelona and Camp Nou. Bloody, he just delivers all the time at the right moments, right? And that's what I'm really, really jealous about. But on top of that, just a cute little... So I'm really good mates with Damien Chouli, who was really good mates with him in Perpignan. He always told me how much a nice guy he was. And we played in 2013. We actually played him four times in a row. We summer toured, June tour in New Zealand three times, and then got them first opening test matches in November. And so we had to end up almost being mates for the All Blacks because we were with them all the time. And after the third test, which was the last one, we had a few beers, whatever. Rémi Thalès, I don't know if you guys remember, from Castres and Racing and France. Fly half, it was his first cap, the third test, and we go into the changing rooms. There's no chance. There's this whole thing about jerseys that did my head in about the All Blacks, but I actually understand now. They only have the one, right? So they couldn't really change them. Took me back to me being a 14-year-old asking somebody for an autograph for a jersey and somebody turning you down. There's not one other country that turns you down for an exchange of jersey apart from the All Blacks. And so you almost, Rémi Thalès was never going to ask Dan Carter, you know, he was never going to do it. And then Dan Carter, I was speaking to Damien Chouli, he realized it was his first cap and he actually took his jersey off and gave it to Rémi Thalès. He didn't know that we had two. He was like, no, just keep yours, frame them both, I'll be happy. It means nothing, but it means a lot. You know, it was kind and there was no cameras, nobody actually ever saw it. And then he sculled a few beers and he made us laugh. And you know, I was like, this guy's a legend.
I mean, you know he's made for it, don't you? And I think on his debut, he scored 20 points, didn't he, hasn't he? Yeah. It's just like on your debut where you're taking over from probably what, King Carlos and Mertens back then. I think he learnt a harsh lesson because I think his first time he was sat on the bench was the 2003 Wellington game against England where we just outplayed them off the park. You know, it was free-flowing rugby at its best. 15-13, it's down to 30.
If that's a cinematic release, it's straight to DVD.
And I think he realised, I don't want to play this sort of turgid, boring game. So, I'd say we shaped his career.
Good on you. Let's fire back into all things Six Nations. And Ben, I mean, one of the wonderful things about having you on is there's so much that we can talk about over the, not just this season, but as we head into 2023 and beyond as well. But it is so good from a neutral's perspective to have French rugby back. Just before we get into, I suppose, some of the problems that they've got at the moment with all the COVID issues, etc., just give us a sense of, you know, is France falling in love again with the team? Where is the sort of the love affair right now?
So falling in love is a bit of a big word because it means you fell out of love, right? So I think that the passion and the love for French rugby has always been there. Whether you love top 14 or not, whether you love Champions Cup or not, the French team is the French team. I mean, I'm sure it's the same in every country and stuff. But in France, it does take a romantic side to it. That will never be touched by professionalism. That is still the 99 semifinal against New Zealand. We're still heroic. We're still capable of, you know, beating the best in the and of the world, even us small, smoking, you know, butter loving French, basically. That's the whole idea that they love it, right? But it's at the moment, that's what I really wanted to insist with earlier, is that it's not so much winning, it's the way that they win. It's the fact that they show some grit. It's the fact that they show some excitement. It's the fact that Fabien Galthié, I mean, fair play. I mean, yeah, he was a French TV commentator for 12 years or something. And his communication is spot on, just saying that they're taking on the legacy of putting a smile on French people's faces. We can't complain on what's happening to us because we are lucky enough to be able to play and we play for everybody out there. And I actually do think it's not just words. They really believe it. So they play with a big smile on their faces. They play with a positive attitude. They play attacking, positive, exciting rugby, which is what France is all about, right? I mean, France is probably the only country in the world where if you win the World Cup by 1 point but play like South Africa did in 2019, they'll complain. And I'll be like, oh, yeah, but it's not really us, right? So they want to they want to identify themselves with who's on the pitch. They want to identify themselves with who's coaching. And they want to identify themselves with the spirit and the attitude that's shown. And that's just what's absolutely wonderful about what's happening at the moment is finally you do a best players in the world 15. There's a few Frenchies in there. Finally. Yeah. I mean, it's been a while. I don't know. We're not going to go through all the ages, but the last couple of years, Thierry Dussautoir was always had to be within the mixer. But then I don't know how many more. Louis Picamol, maybe when he was at its best. Now, poof, Vakatawa has to be considered. Dupont and Tamac obviously are in there. And honestly, Jalibert isn't really, really far.
What about Bryce Doolan?
Exactly.
The rebirth of Bryce. Unbelievable.
No, and he's a delightful character. To go back actually to DC, I thought it was really cute. I don't know if you guys saw it in French press, but he was relating to his time at racing and stuff. And he says, I want to be Batman and Brice Dulin to be my Robin. So he really connected with guys on and off the pitch. And you imagine there's like 10 years difference between him and Brice Dulin. There's obviously a language barrier because I'm telling you, Brice Dulin's English is a bit not the best. And so basically they really had to connect on a different way. And that's what Dan Carter was so good at. He would be, you know, the god of rugby on the pitch, but he had that cheeky bit of him that basically would help him connect with anyone at any time in a real way.
I think Butter Lover is your first T-shirt, by the way. Congratulations. We're off and running. I'm a Butter Lover.
I am a Butter Lover.
What's really interesting, so Johnny Beattie, obviously, you guys do a really good pod, and it's well worth people checking that out as well, Le French Rugby Podcast. But quite damning stories about Fabien Galthié, having played under him. I just wondered, has Galthié mellowed a bit? Is he the same character, but just sort of transitioned from club to international? Is he getting the best out of them because he is firm, or has he changed a bit?
Well, first I'll reiterate, let's do a bit of self-promotion. It's Le French Rugby Pod, you know.
Sorry.
It's really worth the lesson. Fabien Galthié is an enigma, but in all fairness, tell me a genius, tell me somebody extraordinarily successful who isn't. In a good or a bad way. I think I don't want to kill the myth a little bit, but sometimes, you know, the best at any sport, they've got a bit of a dark side. Some of them are not the best people, and some of them have got gaping holes in their hearts and their souls that you don't know about. I know for a fact Fabien Galthié, when I started in 2004, helped me a hell of a lot. Right, he was tough. He was unforgiving. He was extremely demanding of his players in terms of attitude. The same way that he was on the pitch, he had that dog in him. He was, how do you say that? He wasn't Aaron Smith with the perfect number pass, you know, off the edge. He wasn't Antoine Dupont bumping off people and showing his pace. But he was that dog on the pitch that he would never relentlessly ever let go, and he wanted that to shine on his team. And when he's as a coach, he's the same. He wants a strong defensive effort. He wants effort all the time. He wants a special attitude, a cocky attitude, almost to the limit of, you know, being disrespectful attitude, all that to win. It's not to be mean to people. It's not to disrespect people. It's just to win. And so at first, because he went almost straight from 2003, he won the top 14 with Stade Français. And then a year and a half later, after the World Cup, after leaving the World Cup squad, I don't know if you remember, in a bit of a weird way, he didn't play the little final, the third and fourth place. That probably cost him the French job for, 17 years. And then after that, he went straight into coaching. So he was still very, very fresh in it. And all I can tell you is that he's a strategic genius. That is an absolute given. He knows his stuff about rugby. He will create a play on this Tuesday and explain to you X, Y, and Z why it will work. And on Saturday, you will score. Now, do I have a close relationship with him? No. Do I have his phone number? No. Did he help me and launch me as a young player when nobody else had given me as much importance and confidence? Yes. He played me 6. He played me 7. He played me 8. I was like, listen, I cannot play those positions. There's no shape. It's impossible for me. He's like, just trust me, do it. He didn't actually say, you know, some people will wrap you around the shoulder and tell you a cute story and give you a little kiss and butter you up, okay? Because I like butter. And they would really do that in a kind way. That wasn't him. The best example I give is in 2005, the first professional season for me, we play in Bordeaux against Toulouse. Toulouse, Stade Français at the time, was the massive rivalry. And we played in Bordeaux and Chaban-Delmas. There's that huge tunnel that takes you about a minute 15 to actually walk down. It's a bit weird. He spent the whole minute and a half walking right behind me, whispering things in my ear. But it wasn't kind words. He was more psyching me up, you know, for the game. We play the game. I play really well. We win the game. We're in the final top 14. I'm 20. I'm sky high, you know. I'm super, super happy. And at the end of the game, I almost wanted to hug him for the first time in my life. You know, that's to tell you how stupid I was. And I went to him and he pulled his hand at me to shake my hand. I shake his hand, a bit disappointed. Okay, so I'm just going to shake his hand and I was going to go. And he pulls me back. He's like, you're not going to say thank you. So what do you mean? So I gave you everything before the game. Say thank you to daddy. All right, so I didn't say anything. I just fucked off and did my thing. It was like, but that's the type of relationship that we had. And he meant it in a jokey way, obviously, but it's that jokey, never forget who's the boss way.
It very quickly becomes creepy when he says, call me daddy.
Yeah, maybe I spiced that one a little bit. I had a little bit of butter on that one, but you know. Hey,
that's all welcome.
The truth getting away with a good story.
That's welcomed on debut. That's welcomed on debut.
Yeah. Yeah, but you know, so he's so that cost him a few upsets and a few problems, and obviously he's very, very good. So not succeeding is complicated for him. Let's not forget he got sacked from Montpellier, and to be honest, the president of Montpellier really chucked him in the mud, and he tried to absolutely ruin him. But because he had the financial power to wait, he waited, and he won his court case. Then he went to Toulon. The Toulon owner can be a bit special, and he sacked him overnight because he wasn't happy that they lost in the barrage against Lyon, the equivalent of sort of a quarterfinal with Semiradradra, Manonou, Matt Guettaut. It's true, they had a crazy team, but he wasn't happy. Okay, that doesn't mean he didn't do a good job. And then he would not get the French team job over and over again because I'm telling you, I think personally, it's because he's paying what he did in 2003, where he clearly went away from, he clearly, how do you say, didn't play ball with the Federation, basically. Because France is the only country in the world where the president of the Federation appoints the coach. So, I mean, it's a bit complicated when you're one sole person to do it. There's no boards that votes. There's no planning around it. There's literally, when you say it's your mates who elect your mates, well, yes, it is. Because if I'm president of Federation and I'm mates with you, you can influence me and then I'll pick a guy that we like. And that's what it is. So I think he's mellowed down, to answer your question. I think he's learned from all those past experiences. I think he's had the humility to actually say, I am going to do something extraordinary with the French team, but I cannot do it alone. So never forget that he got Raphaël Ibanez, who's doing a fantastic job in the back office. Then he took Sean Edwards, who's obviously extraordinary, but he didn't come because of Fabien Galthié. He came because of Raphaël Ibanez and the Wasp connection. Then he took Karim Ghezzi. Yeah, of course. But Fabien Galthié doesn't know Sean Edwards. It's Raphaël Ibanez. They're mates with him and they always stayed in close contact.
Brilliant.
Karim Ghezzal is the lineouts coach, and then the conditioner who followed him from Toulon. And again, I don't want to praise the French rugby pod, but we had Thibaut Giroud, the conditioner. His work is unbelievable. To be honest, we did a pretty crap job because we didn't ask him many questions. We just listened to him for an hour. It is mind-blowing how important he is in the French setup.
So what has changed? Other than removing the camembert and the vin rouge at halftime of a training day.
He was blunt, honest, and on the same page as Fabien Galthié. I always say that top 14 and international rugby is not the same sport. I'm not saying it's easier or harder. I'm just saying it's not the same sport. It's not the same tempo. It's not the same refereeing. It's not the same pace. It's not the same rewards. In top 14, you get rewarded by being the one with the biggest nuts and the most anger inside you. That's basically what it is. Don't get me wrong. Top 14 is very, very tough. It's complicated because it's unpredictable. Not unreliable, but yeah, unpredictable. Whereas international rugby is all about the speed of execution. And so you get all those players who are created in this top 14 system that creates very, very tough, hardworking players. Yes, but they're not used to somebody weighing 20 kgs less than me and actually going faster at the 60th minute because just that's the special type of conditioning. The reputation of French players being lazy or being unfit is not true. Maybe it was true 15 years ago. It's not the case anymore. But it's unfit to international standards. And that's a completely different thing. And Thibaut Giroud basically rocked up. And he judges the guys not on their weight. Apparently, he changed everything in the weights room and all that. He doesn't want to get bigger. He wants them to be more explosive, even with less weight. So he wants them to produce more power. And from everybody, basically, it's all down to the meters per second or whatever it is. Everything is super, super coordinated. It's all the high-intensity trainings that he calls.
I know that Thibaut is an amazing fitness trainer because he is amazing on the smash. obviously, he was at Beer Ritz back in the day when Bolsch was there. And we had a fantastic night out and he could handle the beast. So if you can handle Andy Beattie, the beast, he was sound at his job. He's got some dance moves. I can't remember what the nightclub is called underneath the, near the casino. Cavill. Underneath the, and he was cutting up a rug.
Ice skates on the dance floor. Was Andy Beattie, was he the benchmark of your mob?
The benchmark? What do you mean?
Well, yeah, I mean, if you can handle
in
the
terms
beast,
of drinking?
Yeah, not on the dance floor.
Yeah, well, no, he was a 6'7" giraffe with reconstructions. He can dance, but he can sink a pint, yeah. massive, lovable, drunk giant who would just throw arms around you and you'd feel like your back was about to snap as he thought he was giving you a loving hug. But yeah, a fantastic man. Fantastic. He's always the benchmark.
He's the benchmark. Ben, I want to ask you about Sean Edwards. We were talking about it, I think it was last weekend. It was a brilliant interview. I mean, I didn't know he spoke French. I don't know whether he spoke French
he doesn't.
But full marks for throwing himself into it and going for it. There are a lot of people who go over and don't make the effort. And, you know, you can see that he is showing that to his players as a commitment and vice versa. But what is the sort of noise around Sean Edwards amongst the team, amongst the press, etc., and the impact he's had?
Well, the general noise is that he's a legend. The general noise is that he is genuine, very, very good at his job and cares so much that he's showing so much passion and energy that the boys bought into his attitude. That's all I care about, is explaining why guys made it in France or not. There's an attitude. There's Nick Abendanon, who will rock up on the first day and already knows a little bit of French. He's always got a smile on his face. He's going to buy into the culture. He goes to the local markets. He's just a lovely, lovely bloke. And there's the other guy who, after 4 years, will know, you know, s'il vous plaît, my check, please, and taxi. That's about it. And that's just disappointing, right? If you go to another country and you don't actually take another, if you try to take Bath and put it in Clermont, it doesn't work, right? Stay at home. Don't do it. Don't do things halfway. And Sean Edwards did not stay at home, did not try to say, I'm the best defensive coach in the world. Do as you're told. He actually had the humility and the intelligence to say, I'm going to adapt to the French way. And I do think, as a coach, obviously, Rafael Ibanez wanted them to come, and as because they're mates, they basically made it happen. I really think he loved the passion of the French, and so he thought, bloody hell, if I can just teach them, you know, a few little logical orders, way of thinking in defense, not only can they be good, but I can have so much fun. You know, there's nothing worse than if you're Sean Edwards, I'm guessing, to speak to a brick wall, you know, but the French, they're not brick wall. I'm telling you, they will soak up all the energy and they will really deliver. So he moved all his family to Perpignan. He's making an effort. So in the interview, honestly, it's a bit of broken French, but that's fine. That's exactly what he said. It's making an effort. It's showing that you're trying. And that really, really counts. The boys love it. But to be honest, all the feedback that I get is that you don't need to speak a lot of French for what he does. When he screams, you understand what he means. And in rugby, you know, ruck, tackle, hands off, all these words are in English anyhow, even in the French setup. But no, they love the attitude. They love the fact. I don't know if you saw that cute video after the Ireland game where he's basically dancing on the seats and stuff. He's genuinely falling in love with the French way because obviously the results are there. But the boys are falling in love with his methods also because they just love the balance between quality and passion.
Do many of your boys speak? Your boys. Do many of the team speak English?
They're 15 years old, younger than me now.
But do many of the boys speak English? So has he got a get down in that?
In the French setup, Raphaël Ibanez speaks perfect. So that obviously that helps him. So does Thibaut Giroud and so does Karim Ghezal and all that. As players, I know Charles Olivon definitely doesn't speak well English. That's the first thing. I met him actually just after he got appointed. I was commentating a Toulon game and he did his first cap with me in the French team. He's a lovely guy, but he's got this Basque. He's a bit like Emmanuel Arinaldoki. He's got this self-confidence about the big bass guys that are just, you know, you love or you hate, but I love it. And he's really, really nice. And I told him, mate, the only thing you need to do, don't be Guillaume Girado to wait 3 years to actually start learning English. It's too important. Start right now. Yeah. And I think he's putting a bit of effort. It's not there yet, but it will get there. I mean, there's Paul Willems and Bernard Leroux. They all speak perfect. I'm sure Greg Aldrit, you know, the big number eight, his father is Scottish, right? So I'm pretty sure. Yeah. Aldrit. You know, I didn't know. He's properly Scottish. And so I'm pretty sure he'll speak great English. I know Romain Tamak speaks very distinctly English. Gael Ficou also. Vakatawa, of course. They'll have a few guys.
So that helps him. I mean, I think what's special about this French team is you always talk about timing of the elements coming together. Mm-hmm. And I think the departure of the old French player, the sort of dictator, the ambassador who felt they were more important, they were very important within a team. They've all disappeared, and you've just got young talent that's proven that they are young talent in terms of what they've won in the world under 20s, 2 years running. And then you bring in a guy who's a bit quirky, you know, I'm not going to say Clive was similar, but quirky in terms of Galtier. And then you build that around with brilliant coaches in terms of Sean Edwards. and you move that forward and it just gets on a roll. And I feel that they're only going to get better. They're going to get better in little bits of game management where they need to. You know, you look at that Ireland game, they were a better team, but you could see they hadn't won. They hadn't had much success in Ireland before. And they were playing around with things that they wouldn't normally do in terms of the way they were kicking. But yet they've come out on top of it. And you saw, you know, everyone saw the social media posts afterwards in terms of what they were singing and how they reacted to winning that game. And you see that as well in terms of what the bonding that they're having as a team together, which have come up through the ranks together, I assume. And I think they're onto something really special that I love to watch. Obviously, then you've got Stardust all over the team, but then you've got the nuts and bolts tied into it. I think it's a really good time for them. And the way that they're talking and laying out that plan for 2023, if they continue on their path that they're on at the moment, I think they actually possibly do need to get burnt a little bit on the way, maybe lose a game that they shouldn't lose, but I think they're onto something.
Do people talk 2023, or is that, I don't know what the sort of the French psyche is around a home World Cup. I mean, traditionally, do you run from that and wince at the prospect of the pressure and the opportunity, or are people now sticking their jaw out and saying, we're up for this? Do you know what I mean? There's something about French rugby where you never quite know.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we don't know, but that's what makes it, you know, you stay on your toes and you stay excited about it. And I think things said it, things are going well, but they haven't won anything, have they? Right. So they lost against Scotland because one of our guys lost the plot. So because we got a red and a yellow in the same game. You talk about Ireland where they were still doing mistakes and stuff. Bernal Lowe still trips a guy. Mm. I mean, in Chase, that's, I think we're the only team in the world that possibly can do that. The last guy was Bakis Botta 20 years ago when he would headbutt from behind a number 9 who didn't have the ball, you know. But apart from him, there's only the French that can do things like that. Never forget that in the history of French memories in terms of sporting achievements, the 98 World Cup for football is the biggest achievement that's ever happened to us. Listen, an extraordinary team that were completely underperformance before, led by Zidane and all them, and Aimé Jacquet, the coach, who was a very funny coach, but obviously did a great job, in their home ground. And I think if that World Cup had not been in France, they would have not won it. The impact of the crowd, the impact of the support, the impact of the well-being when you're at home and stuff was huge. There's no such thing about being overwhelmed by the pressure of being in France, if that makes sense. Now, I don't think that's the reason why 2007 World Cup did not go well for the French team. It's just because they were not prepared for Argentina in the opener game. They had a fantastic team, to be honest. They just completely underestimated Argentina in the opener.
I think they definitely put a little bit of pressure on them. You know, you when you look back to where they first met up and they went back to Marseille, didn't they? And they wanted to get back to the roots of French rugby. I quite like the story, the narrative that and the way it's going in terms of they're stripping back all the sort of the rubbish that's gone for the last 10 years. And they're going, right, let's get back to what is the local Frenchman who goes to watch his local team. Where's his passion pieces? What does he care about? That's what we have to deliver. And then sprinkle it with the French flair that we all know and love. And I really like it. And those two coaches, the coaches have been talking about that 2023 and they see it as a massive opportunity. Again, as you've talked about in what happened in the football in 99, I think they see this as a 98, actually, it must have been
98. Yeah.
They see this as an opportunity and I'm intrigued to watch the show and see where it goes.
But it's also a matter of, we love to host in France, right? No disrespect.
I'm looking forward to being hosted, aren't we, Alex?
Exactly. you joke, but
that's,
we love that.
We
can't wait for that, honestly. We cannot wait for that. And that's the reason why they've, Claude Achis, who is sort of the director of the program of the World Cup 2023, is doing a good job at launching very early to make people aware what's going to happen. The main thing is that the World Cup 2023 needs to be a success in terms of precisely that. Everybody loves France. Everybody loves the French rugby because we're a bit cuckoo, if you want to put it this way, and we love butter, obviously. But then it's completely different whether you go to Nice, whether you go to Perpignan, whether you go to Toulouse, whether you go to Bordeaux. I mean, imagine the trip. You guys always rave about the Lions tours in South Africa and the midweekers and stuff. Of course, imagine the month that you're going to have in France in 2023 if just a bunch of mates jump into a camper van or whatever and start just going around France. you hit Bordeaux, you're basically in heaven, wine heaven. You know, you go to Biarritz, you're on the beach. You go to Toulouse, you eat duck. You go to Perpignan, you're in Spain. You go to Nice, you're in Italy. You go back up the Alps, you know, you can do some extraordinary. And then you finish by Paris, which is probably the most beautiful city in the world. So that's the main reason about 2023. I want people to get absolutely psyched because it's a time to put back France in a beautiful, shiny hotspot of world rugby. But my only worry that honestly worries me a lot is that we have demons in French rugby. One demon is that we can get overly excited and then explode. And the second demon is the fight between the league and the federation. That I already showed a little bit of the tip of the sword in October. And so we couldn't really compete for the Auto Nations Cup because after three games, everybody was laughing. Here we go, the French again. But yeah, we had to rotate 17 players because they only agreed to play three. So that already happened. And then in the future, you just don't know what's going to happen. There's the Minister of Sport, the French Federation of Rugby, and the Federation of Rugby gave the league the right to organize professional rugby. Top 14, second division, and federal one. That contract is out in 18 months or something like that. So everybody is dreading a war in 18 months because the Federation wants to take it back in. So the players at the moment are fully paid and contracted with the clubs. They only get bonuses by the Federation. And they don't get the England bonuses. They get relatively normal bonuses. And so basically, you just don't know what's going to happen. But I just wish, like Tin said, all the stars need to align. You need to have the right opportunity. And I just wish we don't cock that one up because all the stars are aligning.
But then it would be French.
it'd be a wonderful new chapter.
It would just fall into that, it's French rugby.
Yeah, we'll wait another 50 years. Amazing.
No, but in all seriousness, I hope they do. And I hope whoever is at the boardroom table is able to see what the correct answer should be. I mean, maybe that's too much to ask in the game of rugby full stop right now, but fingers crossed. The
only thing they need to bring back is get the cockerel back once we're back in stadium, fans in stadium. Let's get
the Parc des Princes.
Oh,
amazing.
Memories.
But the question, I mean, I think they're quite right and sort of very interesting observations. I suppose the other one I just question, Ben, is whether almost they need to find their best team as well. I mean, they're... And the reason I say that, there's so much talent available. And I just, really, it's just making notes of some of the tens of the last 15 years or so. So Jules Plisson, Skrella, François Trandoux, Rémi Tallez, Lionel Boxis, Camille Lopez, Freddie Michelat, all incredibly talented players, but none of them you would say, I mean, Freddie Michelat obviously stands out from that lot, but none of them have had unbelievably glorious international careers. And whereas you now look at, go on.
I was going to say, well, even with Michelat, though, it's a peaks and troughs, isn't it?
Peaks and troughs, you're absolutely right. And yet you look now at Romain Ntamack, you know, you look at Louis Carbonell, Mathieu Jalabert, even Bello and Joris Seggens. I mean, these are guys who already you feel like they're going to have the careers that you expect them to have. They're going to have proper success along the way. Am I making something out of nothing here? Or is there something in the fact that France have wasted talent in the last 15 years and now they've got an unbelievable selection to pick from and therefore making sure not only that they pick the right people but that they get the best from them is also one of the challenges potentially heading into 2023?
Listen, has France wasted talent in the last 15 years? Of course. Okay, I'm the main example. But to be honest, the... It takes us back to the conversation earlier about saying if you asked 5 years ago, you do the, you know, top world 15, how many Frenchmen will be in it? Maybe a few guys can be contenders for the spots, but we don't know. Now there's actually 4, 6, 7 guys, maybe they're contenders. And I'm pretty sure there's at least 3 or 4 that are definite starters in the world 15. That has never happened. That has never happened. So that's not just talent, but extraordinary talent. Wow. But then if you want to speak about the special position, and I hate to, and we were speaking about DC earlier, but of course, I want to think that all the forwards all do all the job and all the little ballerinas are just there basically to decide what's going on at the end and look good for the pictures. But it's true that having a strong 9 and 10 obviously gives you an edge. And it's not just a strong 9 and 10. It's the best 9 in the world at the moment. And 3 10s, who not only are very good, and the reason why you're saying, you're hinting that they can be so extraordinary is because of their age. Yeah. 3 of them are under 23 or something. That's how good and extraordinary they can be.
Do you think that the influx of some of the world's best tens into the French league has helped Absolutely. With those come through. Because I remember reading, so Mike Prendergast, who I did play with a long, long time ago, when he was at Bourgoin, he was expected to run everything off nine. But then obviously with the likes of who we've talked about, Carter and Wilkinson, Finn Russell, Johnny Sexton, all sort of heading over there, then that has shifted a little bit. It's not always about the nine. It's now got a better balance to it that works with modern rugby.
So there's two things. There's the fact that, like, you're right, the boss of French rugby has always been the nine. That's why there's many nines that kick in French rugby. Yashvili, Morgan Parra, Jean-Baptiste Elissalde, you know, you name them. But where you're absolutely right is I always said basically that the amount of foreigners that we had in top 14 was never an issue for the Dan Carter, the Johnny Wilkinson, the Bakis Botta, the Chris Musoi and stuff. It's when you could pick an average guy and you went for a foreigner. That's what bothered me. Dan Carter clearly influenced a whole generation in terms of ways of training, in terms of ways of approaching the game. Johnny Wilkinson's impact and the legacy that he's leaving behind him in Toulon will last for the next 50 years. Louis Carbonel most definitely has been impacted by Johnny Wilkinson, even though I'm not even sure they ever met. I'm not even sure they ever trained together, but he's definitely impacted him for sure. Romain Tamac, don't forget that the massive star in the 2006 to 2012 sort of period for Toulouse was Luke McAllister. He tore it up over there. And Romain Tamac was living with this 10 who could do everything, who had quads like a tight head prop, and who could basically
ridiculous,
and who could do absolutely anything. And so the influence of those great players is extraordinary. And that's when you define from good to legendary, is the legacy that they leave behind them. And clearly, where I do agree with you is that those foreign stars have left that. And I hope that Finn Russell does the same thing for racing with a couple of guys, with Gibert, who's behind him and all that. But it's shifting from 9 to 10. I don't know if that was a will. I think it was almost a necessity. When you guys were playing in England, we're playing with a 10 and a 12 that could both be 10s, basically. We started to say, right, we might have one actual 10 on the pitch and it might be better than just a catch and pass. I mean, I played with Rémi Thales.
There were times when France played with two nines rather than
Well, Frédéric Michalak was always the problem. He was a 10 originally and then started in the first team playing nine because he was too skinny. But he always said he wanted to play 10, but the boys would look at him and say, come on, you're going to die at 10. So they didn't know how to do it. So he would play nine and then you would play with two. Morgan Parra, instead of calling another 10, put him in the World Cup final in 2011. We function on passion, on love, on heart. And the nine is the one that yelled to me. There was never number 10 that motivated me ever in my life. Nines, yes, I needed to have a strong connection with my nine because we were there to protect him and he was there to make us better. And so that's why we had such strong relationships. I mean, Morgan Parra played both. Baptiste Serin played both. Luku can play both. He ended up 10 with Bordeaux last week. There's Jean-Marc Doussin, you know, the really solid. Yeah. He's in Lyon now, plays 9 and 10 both. In France, that's just how it is. But I think it's a matter of actually asking the 10s now to be kickers. And it's a matter of asking the 9s to be more electric off the base.
Interesting. Very interesting.
Obviously, with these two, the youth that's coming through. Now, when I've talked with Bolsch before over the problem, some of the problems around the Gif ruling and where young players can suddenly sort of disappear to the edge. Do you think with what they've done with the putting these young guys who've had success at junior level into the senior and backing them, do you think that's going to help the sort of the younger players coming through and in terms of making them believe they're going to get opportunities, making old school coaches look at younger players and say, because I always thought, and this might be wrong, so correct me if I'm right, that in France it was more, we'll go with the experienced guy rather than the young guy. Is that going to shift now? Because that's only going to help French rugby.
Yeah, I think we've always been pretty risk adverse because of the stress of French rugby in general. When I mean French rugby, I mean of top 14. Professional rugby in France has been absolutely extraordinary. I mean, I was part of a Stade Français side that for league games would fill up Stade de France probably like four or five times, playing in front of 85,000 people. When you guys would do it once for Quins, you know, I remember the Boxing Day, Harlequins, Leicester, and everybody was chuffed. I was like, well, Stade Français do it six times a year. So he was really creating something out of this world. That had a cost. The cost that you couldn't afford to lose. Imagine the stress that Stade Français had whenever they put 85,000 people in the stand. You know, you need to deliver a performance and you need to deliver a show.
Especially when naked ladies have dropped the ball off on the halfway line.
Yeah. I mean, you need to deliver a show and you need to win, because otherwise, I mean, you don't even know where to hide, you know? So it's really complicated. So the stress in 12-14 has always been there. When you pay Dan Carter 4 times more than a normal number 10 for him to come over to Perpignan and he injures his leg after 6 weeks, you need Perpignan to win, right? So it's not a matter of give him a shot, we'll see, try and learn, you know, resilience, just an attitude towards defeat or not winning straight away, of saying, you know, you win or you learn. That in France can't be the case. And it's the same for the refereeing. That's why the referees, they're not shit individually. They're just, the quality of the delivery is poor because they have so much pressure and they're poorly assisted. So losing at home in France is impossible. So basically, yes, I agree with you. The stress behind it is putting a lot of emphasis on it. And that's why this GIF system, which means you need to have done 3 years of academy. Your nationality is irrelevant. You could be Fijian, Georgian, Safa, whatever. But you need to do 3 years in academy to do it. That's why the poor Scott Spedding, who's got the French nationality, but only did 1 year in academy in Brive and then became professional, was never GIF. He had 25 caps for France, French passport, but he wasn't GIF. And the criteria were getting worse and worse, and the penalties are getting worse and worse for clubs who didn't respect those percentages. At first, it was 45% of your playing squad. Then it was 50%, 55%, and then it ended up being 60% of your match day 23. So you couldn't just have 10 French young guys on the side and not play them. You have to play them. And I have to say, I criticize it a lot because I was just seeing guys sign Georgians when they're 16, sign Safas when they're 16, sign a hell of a lot of Fijians when they're 15 or 16, and just getting them through the ranks. But now the impact and the stress and the penalties are so high that it's true that there's been a shift. I mean, look at Racing and look at Toulon. So Toulon, I think, is because they didn't have any more money. I don't think it's a change of heart. But still, they're delivering some French players all the time. Racing clearly still had money, but decided to invest for the last 5 or 6 years into an extraordinary academy setup. The center of performance is just out of this world. And they're recruiting left, right, and center the best players of the area of Paris, which is absolutely huge, which is about 15 million people out of a 60 million population. And they're recruiting all the best players there to make sure that they win in under 16, 17s, 18s, and get them all the way to the first team. And now the first team of Racing, to be honest, with the director of rugby called Yannick Nyonga, who takes care of all that.
What a player.
There's 12 or 13 almost Paris-born within that team.
Wow. It's heartening to hear, and I'm putting 18 months time in brackets, but it's heartening to hear so much in French rugby coming together. You know, the game needs France to be, absolutely, you know, as fabulous as it could and should be. We asked the question last week as to whether France in full flight was the most beautiful thing in rugby. And I'd put a tick in that. And then, of course, all the All Black fans come in. I'm not saying All Blacks aren't beautiful, but they're the most sort of naturally instinctive rugby players. That's not the right expression, actually. They're the most well-drilled. Australians are the most cunning.
I don't think the All Blacks are the most beautiful team to watch, honestly.
No.
So they're clinical and extraordinary.
They're clinical.
They kick the ball
the
a lot.
The most clinical is. They protect their own end better than anyone else, but then when there's an opportunity.
Exactly. Yes. They're heartbreaking because they're ruthless and clinical, and they just take every opportunity. It was always the thing where the French team would always fight against the All Blacks, and it's the 50th, and Jacques Brunel is like, until the 50th minute, we had them. I said, yeah, but so does 99% of the rugby teams in the world, and you end up losing by 45 points. That's the whole strategy.
It was like when England went on tour down there, and England, Freddie Burns was on the tour, and we were leading loads of times and ended up losing. And someone like Marlon Yard would make a break, and there was a free man on the inside, guaranteed try, but yeah, he'd try and beat the fullback, get tackled, and we missed an opportunity. That never happens in New Zealand. They don't care who scores, but they score every try. That's where their strength is. Obviously, they protect their own end and they're smart, but how clinical they are, no one else really lives with at the moment. This French team's getting up there, but as history shows, they're the most clinical.
That was my point, is that I was trying to find the right adjective to describe each team. South Africa are brutal, Australia are cunning, All Blacks are clinical. France, when they hit their straps, they just play beautiful rugby. And I just wondered, Ben, how full you think the sail is for the French ship right now, and whether this side are genuinely have the potential to be the real deal.
I thought you were going to ask me for an adjective. I was really going to struggle on that one.
No, but let's go with beautiful. It hasn't been beautiful in the last 15, 20 years, but that the Damien Penaud try against Ireland just beautiful. Suddenly made me think of the French sides I watched late 80s, early 90s, Seller, Canberra Barrow, Blanco, etc. They but just it, play. Do
you know what I mean? Watch them again. Watch them again, mate. It's not the same drive.
And it's the array of passing. There's a hook pass. There's an underpass. There's a normal pass. There's a normal offload. There's a double-handed over the top. That's the thing. There's everything, which you don't normally get. Normally, offloads are pretty standard. They're around the back. Whereas there's not. There's ones that you don't expect anyone will ever get. But then that's what you want to see, and that's what you hope that people then watch and want to emulate.
To answer your question, Alex, yeah. I really do think they can be the deal. I do. The reason why I tell you that is because they're still very young. They still have a lot of progress to do on a lot of things. I think it's pretty rare to see a team lose their first three or four lineouts consecutively against Ireland, and then the first ball they finally catch, they score a beautiful try. Yeah. So that quality of delivery and that consistency of delivery, and I mean, you can lose one ball, okay, but not four in a row. That's not the World Cup winning side. You can, you know, defend for the last, what, minute and a half or something when they ended up on their 40 and they pushed back the Irish all the way to the other side of the half-meter line to not concede a penalty and to stay strong. And then Antoine Dupont, who hasn't made a break all game, but then he does compete the ball on the floor and he steals it, so it's beautiful. Yes, okay. But we still tripped a guy on the chase, and Bernard Leroux just chips him and gets a yellow. So, yes, praise us, definitely praise us for what we are, which is extraordinarily talented, super good and stuff. Yes, after the Scotland game in March, everybody was like, yeah, they were good against England, but look at them. They're fucking morons. That's what everybody was saying, because the tight head prop just clocked, Jamie Ritchie or something like that, and we lost the plot. So I do think if they keep on learning, if they keep on maturing, and that's the main reason, is because they're very, very young, and that they keep on building, slowly but steadily, all those important wins, that they need to discover what it is to play with fans in the squad, in the stands. You know what I mean? It's crazy. Yeah. We're going to discover a new rugby within 6 months, and then we'll see. But I think the potential is there. I think the hard work of the backroom staff is there. And more importantly than anything, the will of everyone, league, federation, minister, government, country in general, is there.
Yeah. What's really interesting is that in years gone by, off an answer like that, I'd have said, right, how much is Scotland going to win by this weekend? But I'm definitely not going to do that this time. Fingers crossed we get a game that goes ahead. Just you touched on that at the start. Gut feeling, France against Scotland, are we going to get a game or not?
I'm afraid not. Really? I think the main reason why I say that is because next week there's no Six Nations games. So actually, it would make a lot of sense to try to postpone it a week or at least 3 days or 4 days or whatever. There's nobody in the stands. So for once, they have the flexibility of being able to postpone it precisely when they want. I think it's also going to be down to the goodwill of the Scotland team, which, to be honest, is a bit of an ask. But for the better of rugby at the moment, I think it would be a great sportsmanship for them to allow to do it. But if you try to say, is the game going to happen considering what's happening? It's very, very complicated. There's 7 or 8 cases, whatever, and then somebody who's going to get called up got also a case. So we don't know where the leak is from. We don't know what happened. All we know is that this stuff is particularly contagious, that hopefully, and that's the good news, forget about the rugby at the weekend. None of them are feeling ill. They don't have any symptoms, almost none of them, apart from Antoine Dupont, who had a bit of fever. That's the main reason why I'm like, let's just postpone it a week. Rugby's rugby, but if you have the opportunity to do it, whether you can or not, just do it.
The good thing is, Ben Morrell from Six Nations said that postponement was his preferred option to cancellation. Yeah. So, and I think with how the tournament started and with how those two teams have started, it would be a tragedy for that game not to go ahead. And my only worry is, obviously, I think they're going to make a decision on Wednesday. We hope that no one else tests positive, which gives you a chance to get into it. The only worry is the week after is obviously those Scottish players will still be Premiership bound in terms of, so whether the Premiership teams are happy for them not to play. Obviously, the French guys don't go back and play for their clubs at the moment. But yeah, it's going to need a little bit of goodwill by certain people. But why not? I mean, it'd be worth it, that game.
Yeah, you do want full bore France, Scotland. So highly unlikely to go ahead. But if it does, Ben, in many ways, you could make a similar argument for Gregor Townsend's side at the moment. Just the way that things are coming together for them. Obviously, they blew it against Wales. But, I mean, it's going to be a fascinating test for France if it does happen. And one that you think they're confident and comfortable to pass?
Confident, I don't know if it's the way, but I'm confident for them anyhow. I really do think that in France we have this special way of turning any events during the week and blaming the Scots for it, and blaming the opposition for it, and they'll use it as fuel to basically hit them hard on Sunday, you know, or hopefully on Sunday, but maybe the following week. So I remember being Snowding and Saracens, and we all moaning about the way that, you know, they don't respect us. They're probably in their homes, you know, with their children right now, and we're sitting in this hotel and this and that. So you try to psych yourself up for the thing. So I think they'll use whatever happens during the week and whatever happens during these next couple of days as an extra, if needed, element of motivation. But I think if full teams are there, I really do think France have got a strong, how do you say it? Yeah, a confident performance would be to win by 12 points. I think Antoine Dupont is second to none, but I think Baptiste Serin is unfortunately extremely unlucky to be behind Antoine Dupont because he can deliver some brilliant stuff on a rugby field. So I do think for every guy that's missing, there's an extra good shot behind it. Alter Nations Cup was probably the best example when they didn't have to rotate seven guys. They had to rotate 17 guys and the following week drop another five. So they had to rotate in 22 guys in 2 weeks. So that's rotation. That's creating a team that's played together three times and then still delivering great performance against England. So basically, I think they should beat Scotland relatively comfortably. And whatever happens during the week, they'll use it as extra motivation.
I tell you what, though, Tins, this is a fascinating game for Scotland because after the high of Twickenham, if suddenly they're one from three, the wheels are wobbling again on a vehicle that looked like it was really set to go this time.
Yeah, I think it could be looked at it that way, but I still think that Wales game, they were very dominant in that Wales game. Yeah, they would look at their defence in terms of Wales getting four, but I still think they were dominant in that game. I'm just going through sort of matchups in my head. You know, you've got Pernod versus Van der Merwe. You've got, you know, probably the best home nation scrum half so far in Price against Dupont. You've got, obviously, the tens going back-to-back, Jalibert and Finn Russell. You know, you've got Watson versus Olivion. You've got, I mean, they're the front rows. You've got two great front rows. I never talk about front rows, but Scottish front rows have sort of, with Turner, Ferguson's band, but there are battles all over this. And I really like it. I think it could be open and so loose that both teams can score from anywhere. And if they both go out there and buy into it, it's obviously in France. I don't think Scotland would go there with any fear. They're not going to change their game. It could be a classic. France are one of the best teams in the world for me right now, so I would expect them to win, but I think it'd be a bit closer than what my esteemed partner over here, Ben, is saying.
My learned friend, we shall watch and wait, and your fingers crossed we get full bore, and I think hopefully is the thing that matters the most. Ireland and Italy, it probably is the game that's come at exactly the right time for them. You shared a bit of love last week for Ireland, Tins. I mean, is this the game they need right now? They're searching for something and it can't quite find the fingertips with it.
Yeah, I think it is. I think there have been improvements for Ireland in terms of, I enjoy the way the speed of the ball. I think they are looking to expand their game a little bit. But that said, there are still sort of markers around. They've made the most amount of meters throughout the whole tournament so far, made the most amount of passes, scored the least amount of tries. So they are playing a similar game. It is quite one out run, but it's done at speed. So I've got no problems with it. And then I think Robbie Henshaw's been a revelation for them. I still think they can get Ringrose involved a bit more, but that stat of still being bottom of the try scoring pile is what's going to burn them at the moment. And hopefully with Italy, I think Italy are going to come and have a go again. You know, they've scored three tries, they've only scored one more, but their intent is there. They're going to come and have a go at them. So Ireland are going to have to be on their mettle. You know, they're making line breaks, Italy. They've made quite a few throughout the tournament so far, and there are players who can cause problems. So I'm intrigued by it, but I expect Ireland to get control of it and come out worthy winners. But I think they need a performance where they stick to what they've been trying to do and really sort of loosen those strings and enjoy it.
Stat, 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 stat. I'm really proud of you. I feel I'm rubbing off on you.
But, you know, it's just boring. It's my life.
Becoming a fully-fledged Norse, and I'm extremely proud of you for just that. Wales-England. This show's never really been about the details. Only now that we get to Wales-England, which is one of the greats. It's one of the great fixtures. We'll do a bit more on Thursday on this one, actually, Tins, as well. But Ben, from your perspective, Wales 2 from 2, and some people saying, how on earth? England 1 from 2, and everyone going, yes or no. How do you call this one going into it?
So Wales really remind me a sore memory, which is 2012. I think they went on like a losing streak that was unheard of for them, losing their 4 November tests, losing their 3 June tests, and losing their last Six Nations games. So they came to Paris for the opener of the 2012 Six Nations, losing 9 or 10 games in a row or something like that. And they beat us in Paris. And everybody was like, listen, they're going to collapse. But they just ended up winning game after game and doing the Grand Slam. So I'm not saying they're there yet. I'm just saying they have extraordinary weapons in the backs that deliver some fantastic tries. So we were all obviously gutted for the Scots, or I was gutted for the Scots a couple of weeks ago, because I just thought they shit the bed, really. And but in the same time, you look at Wales, they score some pretty brilliant tries. You know, it wasn't like an intercept and a kicking game and this and that. They really delivered some positive rugby.
From the Wales perspective, there's still a lot of questions around that. Obviously, they haven't finished a game playing against a team with 15 men. Their best player is Luce Rees-Zammit or the red card. So, you know, they have the lowest, I'm going to pull some more stats out, lowest meters made in the whole tournament, but yet they've scored 6 tries. Lowest passes, lowest players touch the ball. There is a bit of a question mark still, but the one thing they needed was confidence and a change in fortune, especially for Wayne Pivac. Now, whether they can do it against England, who also haven't really found their straps, I think it's the best time for them to be playing England. England are due a performance. They need another performance to back up Italy. I thought it was better against Italy, but it's that old adage of, unfortunately, you don't get credit in the bank for Italy. So it's going to take them to go up there and turn up. And we know that Wales have got players, Liam Williams, Luce Rees-Zammit. I think there's some interesting selection issues they could do in terms of... Who would you prefer to see at fullback, Lee Halfpenny, or would you prefer to see Liam Williams? Is Josh Adams back now?
Adams is back, George North's back, and I think Davis is back.
So then the options that they could throw into the mix of that back three makes it a little bit more of a spicier team in terms of individual stardust. So we'll wait and see. But Wales will be happy, but I think they've got away with a couple. They'll know that, and they'll try and bring a performance at home. And England need to bring performance as well.
I mean, we get accused of being an Eddie Jones show, and we'll never critique England.
I apologise in advance. You're not going to get that from me, mate.
No, but that's wonderful, and you know that's why we want different views and different.
We've got one sicko fanboy on the show of Eddie Jones. Everyone else is pretty balanced.
There's a bigger point there, which is none of you would ever actually. I suppose Tins, you would with Sir Clive, but Hask is definitely not an apologist. You know, he is pretty forthright in his views of his time with Stuart Lancaster. But you know, he enjoyed great success under Eddie Jones. Therefore, you back him. Is that an unusual thing? I don't know.
No, so I don't think it is. I think you still... The problem is with Eddie, and why it makes it hard for someone to have, is the enigma of it. And he knows he'll be saying something completely different in camp. And that's where it sits, is the fact that you can't describe what he does in camp to someone out of camp. And then it, just because you stand up for him all the time, we get the frustration of Eddie Jones, which is... Why are you saying that? That is actually not correct. Have you not watched the game? Oh, I didn't prepare them right. Well, what did you prepare them to do? And that's the frustration side of it. But then in camp, it can be completely different. And we can never, unfortunately, until someone puts eyes on, cameras in the walls and in there, then we won't know that. So we just have to put up with it.
All right. Go on then, Ben. Off the long run.
You raise a great point as to the fact I don't know Eddie Jones personally. And I think there's a proper split of personality, which is what he wants to show to the media, represent and almost shield his players to what he actually says to his players and the way that he behaves in camp. So I think that's a very fair point. My only issue, which is a big issue, is that where has England gone since October 2019? Absolutely nowhere. They have made zero improvements, and they've just not showing me that they're humble enough to say, right, the team that beat the All Blacks in the semi-final probably produced the best game of rugby in a long, long time, should have been changed to play the Springboks. My personal view. Because you have to adapt to the adversary, you have to adapt to the physicality of the Springboks. That's just my view. But he didn't have the guts, basically, to drop anybody who played so well in the semi-final. It was just an impossible thing to do. And since then, I think there's been... How do you say that? People have been complacent with him because he's so good to England rugby, because obviously he's a fantastic rugby coach. But what bothers me is his attitude of again, like I said to you, maybe it's what he says, which is what I know, and it could be different to what he actually does on a day-to-day. But for me, the last bit was the last Auto Nations Cup game against France in October or November. Everybody saw the same game, right? I was there. They could have lost 100 times. They should have lost at least once or twice, okay? But rugby is rugby. Sport is sport. Don't get me wrong. That doesn't mean that they stole their victory. It just means that shit happens. And end of the game, he gets the microphone pulled to him, and I was just expecting a little bit of sportsmanship. I was expecting a little bit of class. I was expecting a guy to come up and to say, you know, fair play, France. You guys give a right go for our money, but all those youngsters, you've got promising guys and stuff, but just today it was for us, and go well. No, and he turns around and he goes even deeper into that dickish attitude that I hate, which is basically he just goes, oh, I tell you what, it took us a little bit more time than normal to win. He doesn't say we could have lost. He said it took us a little bit more time to win because we were 2% off our normal performance. What is he saying? I mean, does he think none of the English players, as much as they believe what he says in camp, do they think they don't listen to the press? And then he says, no, actually, it's not a second team that we beat today because of the data that we picked up on them today and during the week, we realize they're as good, if not better, than the first team. I'm like, is this guy serious? Just be kind, be class, be relaxed, you know?
But that's what he does. That's what cost you guys.
That's precisely what cost you guys the opener of the 2020 Six Nations in February. Is because he was kept on tweaking it, and giving motivation to the French team by saying how shit we were and how they were going to deliver a great performance. And they got smoked that day. Yeah. If Antoine Dupont doesn't lose the plot at the 78th minute and 15 seconds and kicks it out because he thinks the game's over, then basically England don't even get that bonus point, which end up them winning the Six Nations 6 months down the line. You know what I mean? It's the true greats will know how to adapt to who, when, and how. And I just feel that with France, he's constantly staying in his overconfident way where he should adapt to France. Do not feed the beast. Do not chuck oil on the fire. And during that week, that's what he did. He chucked oil on the fire, and then he has to pay. And I think the true greats, they'll recognize that they did a mistake. They'll be like, right, fair play. You guys did well. You guys deserve and go. But he never does. He knows me.
Well, that's because he doesn't do what people expect and want him to do. And this is the thing, you know, if only we had someone that we knew who had, you know, who polarized all markets and all opinions on this show. The problem is with him is sometimes it comes back and he's right. You know, we went on that 7-game losing streak and everyone's like, what are you doing? You just completely changed the way. And then behind the scenes, it suddenly turns out that he's overtraining them to get them used to the short weeks in the World Cup. And then obviously we go to the World Cup, we play really well apart from the final. And again, I was with you on the final. I'm like, you hear it came out overtraining again, and does he change it to suit what it is and whether he picked the right team? And generally, and then it comes back, we win the Six Nations. He's always got that get out of jail because he wins the next thing. He might not do it prettily, but it gets the job done. And you're like, but where's the sometimes? And now from the autumn to this Six Nations, it's all about where's the performance, because there's only so long you can play at a level where you're just winning before that suddenly becomes you're just losing.
And I would say, as a caveat, he was extremely gracious post the Scotland game and very, very congratulatory to them. And maybe that's, you know, we're all searching for rugby utopia. I'm definitely not an Eddie Jones apologist. I'll leave that to our esteemed colleague.
But this is the thing, is when he was on the show, he's completely different to that. He was so relaxed and he was so just normal. It's like,
but we want characters in the game, you know, and today it's black and tomorrow it's white. And it's the same thing we're looking at, but good for the game when you stand back, is it not? Or am I Ben's looking quizzical?
No, I'm all about just not getting caught up in the storm anymore and just sit back and try and
that doesn't drive ticket sales and viewing figures.
The main idea about rugby is that you can mouth before the game, you can build up all that hype, you can smash the shit out of each other for 80 minutes, but you will always grab a pint and celebrate a victor, basically, who deserves it, right? That's what differentiates us from all the other sports in the world, in the fact that we're able to do that with such an... not every sport in the world, it's a bit mean. I loved the MMA guys, basically, when they mouth man mouth off before the games. They absolutely destroy each other's faces, and they end up, you know, praising each other and wishing them well for their families while one of their eye sockets is behind their heads, you know. Yeah. And that's what I really, really like. And it's just one of those things. He really disappointed me, the Auto Nations Cup feedback. It was a clear, easy opportunity, especially when you've won, to praise, you know, the others and to say, go well, guys, and I hope we meet you in 2023. It'll be a fireworks. You know, that's what I just hope. That's rugby. Stir the pot, chuck oil on the fire as much as you want before the game, during the game, but after, I think we need to show class and actually and just be relaxed and good people.
Interesting point.
There you go.
Strong point. Okay, let's just finish a quick prediction. France, Scotland will be.
Yeah, also I say 22-10.
22-10.
Ooh, I think it's going to be in France. Hopefully the weather's good. I think it's going to be a higher score than that. I think it's going to be a little bit closer. I'm going to say 32-26.
Oh, nice.
To France.
Ireland by
34. I reckon they'll hit 40. 42 and take off 34.
Good.
45-10 to Ireland.
Love it. I'm fascinated by this. Wales, England.
I've put a short victory of Wales, 16-15, because I really do think that England are going nowhere after that Italy victory. I haven't seen any improvement. I haven't seen any transformation. I haven't seen anything, to be honest. And I do think Wales, like you said, with a lot of flaws, with a lot of lacking, but still with spirit and with confidence building, I think they can snatch it.
Brilliant. That was Ben Kayser. Lovely to have him for his one and only show. What is amazing is that this is where it's really good having you on. I don't think anyone's ever tipped against England before on this show.
No.
It feels a bit funny. Tins?
I think that Eddie is going to have seen my 23 that I posted this week, and he's going to take inspiration out of it. There's going to be a few changes, and obviously, half of them we can't pick, actually, of my 23 because they're not in the bubble. I think England will get the job done. I just hope it's with a performance. I'm not sure it is. I'm going to say England by 4, 20-16.
Good. Very interesting. Just before we wrap up, actually, Ben, have you had some really nice feedback for your stuff on ITV and BBC? Are you getting quite a lot of love for your commentary and your punditry?
Yeah. Just not love is not the word, but just like you said, that people enjoy having a different opinion. I try to stay fresh and passionate because I love rugby. And the day that I start to be predictable, then I'll give me a nod and I'll stop.
Speaking to Ben, you don't ever doubt his love of rugby, really, do you?
No, that's very true.
But it's like Haas speaking about himself.
We've been a bit quiet on him this week. It's a lovely little knife at the end. Well done.
Everyone, if you haven't heard, Hask has released a song. Please have you not seen it?
No.
Released his first track.
Oh, has he?
Yeah.
Kudos. He's good at what he does in that regard.
But then, it sounds all right as well. I want to say it's called Make What We Feel or something. Make Me Feel. Right. Not Make Me Feel, but
check something it out.
Like. But yeah, so well done to Ask. We'll give him
good on him.
But we'll give him a knife because we know he likes, after a knife, a little bit of pat on the back.
Yeah.
After his dad's told him he was shit when he came off the field, he goes to his psychologist and says, no, you're all right. So we'll be both the knifer and the psychologist in one.
Good. We'll be building up the track next week. Ben, it is so good to have you as part of this little, I don't even know what it is, this little entourage. And we've got a lot to look forward to between now and 2023. I have to say, when you were doing your bit for the French Tourist Board, I was actually getting incredibly excited about GBNR on the road. Le road trip. Let's make it happen. We'll have
start
a lot
learning
of fun.
French.
You start learning French. Yeah, back to my GCSE trickle or 4B. Good on you. Any final thoughts? Any other business this week? Fingers crossed for the French game. Or are you studying? What's keeping you busy otherwise? There's a lot of impressive books in the literature behind you.
Yeah, but don't worry. There's the wine fridge just on the other side. When I get overcooked, you know.
One goes with the other, right?
Absolutely. Yes. Absolutely. No. Just listening basically to all the announcements. Can't wait for your mate Boris to deliver a good plan. Get us out of this. Get us moving again. And then please, please, no more cases tomorrow morning for the French guys.
Fingers crossed. Well done, Ben. It's very nice to have you
all aboard, and we'll have you back very soon. Good luck for the weekend. Lord, likewise. That is it for this week. The good, the bad, and the rugby. It's good to have a fifth member in the team. We will be a little bit more careful from here on, though. 3 weeks running, we have drilled almost exclusively into the game of rugby. I'm not quite sure what's happening. We've done 25 minutes on the breakdown last week, 45 plus minutes on French rugby this. What is happening? We need to have a summit meeting sooner rather than later. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Thank you for watching, as always. Don't forget to check out the website. That's goodbadrugby.com for the Norse's stats. I have to say, I think Tins and the Norse are getting closer and closer as each week goes on. Lots of good stuff there ahead of the next round of the Six Nations. There's also lots of merch if you want to get stuck into some GB&R product. All yours, Rob Brydon. We'll see you on Thursday for the Premiership Preview Show. And next week is going to be an absolute ripper. We have got the one, the only, joining us. We'll see you then. But from all of us, bye for now.
Thank you so much for listening to The Good, The Bad and The Rugby. It can't have been easy.